From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
To be charged with obstructing feels very appropriate in this moment, because really where the obstructing is going on is in that Senate and in that White House.
Last week, we told you about the March for Voting Rights that the Poor People's Campaign led on the Texas capital of Austin. But the group has been busy with urgent activism in the nation's capital as well. Arrests of activists at a D.C. women's march in late July, including the campaign's co-chair, the Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, were followed by another march this past Monday that included arrests of both the Reverend William Barber and Jesse Jackson, among hundreds of others. We'll get an update from apparent career criminal Theo Harris.
Social media platforms, thanks to the way the law is constructed, don't just get to set their own rules. They are judge, jury, and executioner.
The Center for Countering Digital Hate may not be a name that rolls off the tongue, but the group's work is at ground zero for disinformation, manipulation, and social disintegration today, social networks, and those who control them. With recent findings on how utterly these networks have failed at reining in anti-Semitism, the center keeps adding to its invaluable body of research. We'll meet CCDH CEO Imran Ahmed.
Do you consider yourself a spiritual innovator, an artist, an activist, a change agent, an entrepreneur, a church leader, or a visionary educator? Are you too curious? Or are your ideas too bold for the institutions or communities you serve?
Spiritual entrepreneurship. It might sound like a trendy cliche, but the idea of innovation in spiritual context is nothing new, and modern ways of connecting are opening new opportunities despite recent restrictions due to the global pandemic. On this week's show, Spencer Burke will be with us to talk about Soul Arise 2021, a meeting place for spiritual innovators coming this fall.
I'm Ray Kirstein, reporting from the intersection of religion, government, and scorched earth propaganda campaigns. Hey, do you remember when the political religious right was adamantly insisting there was no real danger from COVID-19, especially for the faithful and Trump true? Well, just look at them now. As the fourth wave becomes a reality, driven in great part by their own followers refusing to be vaccinated, shrill attention seekers like William Koenig are saying what must be said. The global pandemic is, in fact, drumroll please, the judgment of God on the United States for being so pro-LGBT. Please forgive me for reading directly from one of the endless torrent of brutally partisan fundraising emails that spew from the purportedly religious Family Research Council, the longtime head of which, Tony Perkins, continues to serve in a prestigious government role on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Quote, earlier this year, during an intense debate on the House floor over the Equality Act, Representative Greg Stube, Republican of Florida, told his colleagues it was time for them to hear the truth about the transgender issue. He read from the Bible, sharing what God says about sexuality, but many Democrats aren't interested in the truth or God. Nice, Tony. Real nice. Oh, and just for good measure, FRC is also in separate emails demanding that their obedient followers, supporters, sister wives, in their words, tell your senators to vote against the infrastructure deal. Of course, placing the word deal in scare quotes. While Welton continues with the show, I'm going to go look in my King James for the scriptural ban on making sure our bridges don't collapse out from under us.
I hope Ray comes back. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, some of you have, please let me say very sincere thank yous to you. Now, if you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now to our first guest. The Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris is the very busy co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, where along with the Reverend William Barber II, she is helping mobilize activism on the most important moral crises of our time. In addition to a powerful message, she's got to have a darn good lawyer because she keeps getting herself arrested and yet is free to join us again here on State of Belief Radio. Liz, how wonderful to have you with us again. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
You have been so, so busy this summer. In just the past couple of weeks, the march on the Texas Capitol in defense of voting rights, the recent women's march, and now the massive action in Washington last Monday. Does it feel like we're reaching critical mass on these issues at last?
So, indeed, I think the spirit is moving. The Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, you know, held a put forward, launched a season of nonviolent moral direct action, because when the Senate said that they weren't going to pass that $15 an hour minimum wage increase, when they said that they weren't going to decide on the For the People Act, when we're living in a country that has 140 million people who are poor and low income, and yet the eviction moratorium wasn't being continued, all of this, you know, all happening at the same time with this onslaught of voter suppression laws being, you know, stated and brought into reality. And, you know, already 18 states with hundreds being suggested in 49 states, you know, we, the people that are kind of most impacted by both voter suppression and economic injustice and systemic racism, ecological devastation, this war economy, said, you know, this is a time for action. And it's been it's been inspiring to see, you know, the groundswell of activism, of holy uprising that folks are engaging in. You know, when we marched from Georgetown, Texas to Austin and were gathered with thousands, tens of thousands of people, you know, in a very short period of time, when almost more than folks have ever seen in Washington, D.C., engaged in massive nonviolent civil disobedience in front of the Hart Senate building. You know, I think what we're seeing, and people from all over, all walks of life, you know, are seeing that they have to do their part in making sure that we defend this democracy and put out the injustices that exist that just do not have to be.
Where is the ongoing resistance to justice coming from?
Well, I think we both see ongoing resistance coming from the bottom for change, you know, resistance in terms of political activism and organizing. But what we're confronting is, you know, I think a status quo, a political system that has gotten very used to, for the past 50 years, generation, you know, not bringing issues of systemic racism and economic justice into the forefront. I think we've gotten very used to, you know, a political system that is easier to kowtow to the Chamber of Commerce and the wealthy elite, rather than the needs and demands of the people. And so, you know, again, we've seen some positive change happen in the last couple of months that show that if we go in that direction, change is possible, right? I mean, something like the child tax credit, which actually lifts, you know, a large segment of people from the bottom so that people can actually, you know, thrive more in the society, but it's temporary. And it just shows the potential. We can celebrate it, but we can celebrate it that shows that if we put our minds to it, if our elected officials actually, you know, are interested in ending poverty, in addressing systemic racism, in saving the planet, and in shifting this war economy that is so used to the militarization of our communities rather than the thriving of our lives, that real change is possible, and it's tangible. It's there. But I think that, you know, again, what we saw, for instance, with the For the People Act, you know, Senator Manchin from West Virginia was supportive of it when John Lewis was alive, when McConnell was the majority leader. But now that Schumer is, now that it has a potential for it actually to go through, we've seen the Chamber of Commerce get very worried and then get into the ear of Manchin and other senators and put real pressure. But what we know is that in history and in our current day, when the people organize, you know, folks from West Virginia, like we have in our Poor People's Campaign, folks from Arizona, you know, putting pressure on Senator Sinema, you know, folks here in New York where I live, you know, putting pressure on Senator Schumer, and all of us as a nation putting pressure on President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris to actually use the power that folks have to pass the kinds of policies that the vast majority of Americans are asking for and that will benefit, you know, so many people, especially from the bottom up.
When someone asks you what are the key issues the Poor People's Campaign is focusing on, what's the answer to that question?
So in this season, we actually have pulled out five issues because we can see that it's within the possibility of the Senate before it recesses to pass. And that means ending the filibuster, and not just ending that filibuster to pass a voting rights bill, but ending the filibuster so that is blocking the expansion of healthcare, that is blocking, you know, making people compromise too much on an infrastructure bill, you know, that is being used to uphold, you know, policies that are not to the benefit of all, especially not to the poor and low income. Mm-hmm. So the second demand is about passing all the provisions of the For the People Act, not watering it down, not leaving dark money in our politics, not saying, well, we'll just be okay with passing a Voting Rights Restoration Act when it's written, because it's not written yet, right? Uh-huh. And so for folks that are saying that they're supportive of that, but they're not supportive of the For the People Act, you know, our question to them is, well, does that mean you're for dark money in our politics? Does that mean that you don't want, moms of all kinds to be able to you know, have drive-through voting, you know, and to have automatic registration at the age of 18, because again, like folks can go off to war, you know, but they registered to do that, but they're not automatically registered to vote. So the third is about that voting rights restoration. The fourth is about connecting this voter suppression attacks with economic justice and immediately passing a federal minimum wage increase to $15 an hour. And then the fifth is about our immigrant brothers and sisters, mm-hmm. the fact that we need protections and dignity and rights and a solid pathway to citizenship for all 11 million undocumented immigrants. Mm-hmm. Now, those five demands are just some of the overall agenda of the Poor People's Campaign. Mm-hmm. You know, this past spring, congressional leaders introduced a resolution that is inspired by our agenda. It's called the Third Reconstruction, fully addressing poverty from and low wages from the bottom up. And in there, or in our Jubilee policy platforms, you know, there's a whole lot of other issues that come out of the struggles of the 140 million poor and low income people. Yeah. But in this season, this month, by August 6th, we're saying these five things need to happen. And if they do, we'll celebrate them and keep on organizing. And if they don't, you know, we're going to intensify our organizing and our agitation.
Liz, I worry that the political religious right has been effective at disconnecting religious morality from matters of economic and social justice in the minds of many. So when people ask, why are reverends leading these campaigns? Why are these religious issues? What do you tell them?
So I love this question, right? I was raised in the church, and I am an ordained minister and a biblical scholar. And that's because I have read our texts and our and studied our traditions. And there are more than 2,000 scriptures in our holy texts that talk about how a nation is judged by whether they welcome the immigrant neighbor, whether they are putting forward programs that lift from the bottom, welcoming the homeless, you know, taking care of children and orphans and folks that have whose wages are too low. Right now, if you start in Genesis and you go through Revelation, you know, what you see is over and over again, an arc of talking about these questions of economic justice, and not just on a personal level, on a societal level, right? That last judgment in Matthew 25, you know, he says to the nations that are gathered, if you feed me, if you care for me, if you clothe me, if you house me, if you visit me when you're in prison, then what you've done is done this to Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. And when you haven't done it, and again, it's not just as individuals, it's not just as individual congregations, it's as a nation, we will be judged by how we have treated the poor and the marginalized. And so it's from that this interreligious moral movement from below is really, you know, building power. And we have folks from, you know, denominations and faith traditions that represent millions of people across this nation who see that the moral issues of our day are really about raising wages and expanding healthcare. I mean, the very things that our sacred texts speak so much about, but have now been, you know, separated from kind of a personal morality and a sense of salvation without saving the soul of our society and lifting from the bottom.
Specifically on voting rights, why do you think all people of faith and of no faith need to engage and engage right now on this issue?
So what we're seeing happening right now in the United States is the biggest attack on voting rights since the Reconstruction right following the Civil War. And if the kind of voter suppression tactics and legislation goes through like it's being proposed, you know, who will be impacted the most is those that people of faith should be most concerned with. It's the poor. It's women. It's Black people. It's Native people. It's low-wage workers. It's LGBTQ folks. It's the differently abled, right? And again, if we go back to our texts, if we go back to our traditions, the idea that people have a voice and need to have a voice in the decisions that determine their lives, that is a through line through our texts, as well as this commandment over and over again to organize society so that everybody's needs are met. It's not that we should allow for voter suppression tactics to be, you know, smuggle in politicians that then prey on poor people. That's exactly what the prophets are so riled up about throughout our traditions. That's exactly what Jesus, you know, says, woe to you hypocrites who have focused on these, you know, issues of filibuster and compromise, but neglected the weightier matters of the law, and which is justice for women and for the poor and for people of color. And so this is a moral issue. And we must see it as so. And we must see that if we're not loud about the issues that Jesus and God care the most about, then we're not really following in the footsteps of those that we profess to honor and worship.
In late July, you were out front at the Women's March in our nation's capital. What was the focus of that event?
So on July 19th, we had an amazing event with about 100 women from all across the country. It was on the anniversary, the 173rd anniversary of the Seneca Falls Convention, where women had gathered with Frederick Douglass and others to put forward a declaration of sentiments. And we said, as women from all races, ages, genders, sexualities from across the country, that as our voting rights are being attacked, we were compelled to put together a statement that talked about the disparate impact and the immoral obstructionism of the Senate and of the White House that is refusing to act on these issues that are impacting women by far the most. And so it was a beautiful action with women from all around the country who were willing to put themselves out there and risk arrest to make sure that this that this message that voting rights is a struggle that women should be taking up, that all people of conscience should be taking up, and that there's a movement that's calling forward people to act justly in this moment.
I am assuming that ongoing plans are in place for keeping that issue front and center even as we get into the autumn months. Would that be right?
That's right. I mean, we're going to have to keep up the pressure around all of these demands from this season. The connection between voting rights and economic justice, the connection between systemic racism and ecological devastation, the connection between this false narrative, this moral narrative that's out there that again blames poor people and immigrants and women for, you know, all of society's problems, tries to pit us against each other and then feeds us this lie that this is as good as it gets. And so instead, we are going to keep on organizing, keep on mobilizing, and keep on building a powerful movement that has the power and the ability to be able to kind of make the power structures say yes. Say yes to voting rights, say yes to anti-poverty work, say yes to addressing systemic racism, when right now we're still hearing too many no's out of those in power.
Now, this past Monday, there were hundreds of arrests at Poor People's Campaign March in Washington. What was the focus of that event?
So that event was led by low-wage workers and faith leaders. We still were putting forward these five demands of this season of ending the filibuster, passing the For the People Act, restoring voting rights, raising the minimum wage to 15, and protecting all 11 million undocumented immigrants. But in this case, it is really emphasizing the moral necessity for faith leaders to be out there standing hand in hand with low wage workers. You know, in this pandemic, we've started calling low wage workers essential, right? Mm-hmm. But folks are still not being paid enough money to be able to afford all of the essentials of life. And this, given the fact that senators were elected, that the president was elected with a platform of raising the minimum wage, and we haven't seen it happen yet. Mm-hmm. And so we were really focusing on the intersection between economic justice and voting rights, and not separating out saying we're only here for voting rights or we're only here for a living wage, but seeing the interconnection of these issues and seeing that in particular in the lives and in the demands of low-wage workers and of faith leaders.
In both of those events, people who were there were caught by the police and been arrested. I wonder, what do they arrest you for? And then let me just put with that, do you think the growing arrests are an attempt at intimidation, or is it a sign that the movement's growing?
So I think what was kind of amazing about the charge, both on the Women's March action, as well as in this one this past Monday, is that the charge, the citation is for obstructing. It's for obstructing traffic. But to me, that feels very important because we're calling out the moral obstructionism of the Senate and of the White House at this moment. And instead, what's being put on us is that because we're making our voices heard, because we're delivering our demands to the Senate, because we're insisting that our politicians actually follow the will of their constituents. Like, for instance, in West Virginia, 79% of Democrats, Republicans, and independents all support the For the People Act. And yet Senator Manchin stands and says that he's not going to sign on to it because there isn't enough unity around it. Well, 79% of everybody, that's a lot of, you know, so that's obstructionism. And so to be charged with obstructing feels very appropriate in this moment because we're really where the obstructing is going on is in that Senate and in that White House. I think that the numbers are because the movement is growing. And because people are saying that they are willing to put their bodies on the line to stand up for what's right. And that in this moment of history, to have people coming forth, you know, including many folks that have never engaged in nonviolent direct action before, including folks that, you know, just heard that we were doing these actions and felt like they had to be there in the numbers, including low-wage workers who have a lot going on just to keep families fed and housed, but who felt like they were compelled to take this action, you know, I think it shows the power that's growing.
Liz, tell our listeners again, please, how they can be supportive and involved in what you're doing.
So the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, we're organized in almost 45 states across the country. We have local coordinating committees of impacted leaders, of moral leaders, clergy, activists, advocates from all across these states that come together, you know, organize together, you know, hold up some of the local struggles and issues that are going on, connect it with a state legislative agenda, and then participate in these nationally coordinated actions. So if folks, you know, no matter where you're living, please connect with the Poor People's Campaign. You can go to the Poor People's Campaign website. It's www.poorpeoplescampaign.org. You can text us to join. You can sign up for our e-newsletter. But that way you get a chance to hear about the powerful work that folks are doing and be a part of it. You know, we are saying that this is a movement moment and it needs everyone.
The Reverend Dr. Liz Theoharis is co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, which is currently leading a season of nonviolent moral direct action. Keep up with all that's going on at www.poorpeoplescampaign.org. Liz, thank you so much for using your one phone call to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
Up next, it's the disappointing findings on social media giants' failure to rein in anti-Semitism on their platforms. And later, Soul Arise 2021 with spiritual entrepreneur Spencer Burke. Now, if you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. Religion and Radio Done Differently. We all know unfettered misinformation about hate flow from today's social media, but in recent months, Facebook and Twitter have repeatedly claimed to be working hard to flag COVID lies and bigotry-laden screeds. So how are they doing? Terribly, according to my next guest, who heads up the increasingly essential Center for Countering Digital Hate. His recent New York Times column said as much, and I am grateful to be joined right now by Imran Ahmed. Imran, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
So your latest research focuses on anti-Semitism. What commitments from the social media giants were you checking up on?
Well, look, we know that anti-Semitism is one of the oldest, most pernicious forms of racism. It's a cancer that, if you allow it into your society, can metastasize easily and can reconstitute itself. And we have done a lot of work in our societies over the past few years, you know, past decades, centuries, in fact, to make sure that Jewish people feel safe and that they are able to participate fully in public life and public discourse. One of the ways in which anti-Semitism has found a foothold in our society is that it's found social media to be a particularly amenable place to them spreading the rhetoric, the misinformation, the conspiracy theories that underpin hatred of Jews. And so that's why we looked at the commitments made by social media platforms, which say that not only do they ban anti-Semitism on their platforms, but also they ban the precursors to anti-Semitism, Holocaust denial, dehumanizing rhetoric. And we wanted to have a look at their, how they really dealt with it. So look, my great contention is that the true measure of morality is not what you say you will do in public. It's what you do in private when you think no one is looking. Mm-hmm. And what we did was we reported 715 bits of hardcore anti-Semitism, the kind of stuff that would offend you if you saw it immediately. And we then went back and saw what action was taken by those platforms against that content. Well, you know, social media companies, tech people, they love numbers. They love statistics. I can now put a number on how much they care about anti-Semitism, 16%, because that's how much of the anti-Semitism that we identified they actually took down.
When you looked at what you found, were you surprised by any of it?
It's hard to surprise me. You know, we do work on the proliferation of Islamic State terrorist narratives of misinformation that might lead to people dying because they get information about their health vaccines that's wrong. So I wasn't surprised, but I was disgusted. For me, this is not a technological question because this is a moral question. Do you have the will to act on hate when you see it? And we took out all the algorithm questions because, of course, we reported it to them. We handed them the anti-Semitism on a silver platter and said, do with it as you wish. And they cared, exactly 16%.
Where else do you see religion get dragged into online hate and or misinformation campaigns?
We see religion as something it is a reflection, of course, of offline religious intolerance. And there is religious intolerance of all kinds towards all religions in different parts of the world and among different communities. So there is anti-Muslim hatred in parts of Europe, in the US, in other parts of the world. There's anti-Jewish hatred. There's anti-Christian hatred. Faith groups find themselves under attack all over the world. And it's really important that we don't allow the world's most powerful communications platforms to become vectors for intolerance, because their power is more than any other form of communication. They have a direct line into our lives in a way that a newspaper doesn't. When you pick up a newspaper, you're picking up something and you're in a critical frame of mind. When you're watching the news, you're thinking, you know, what do I think about this? When you're consuming social media, you're looking at pictures of, you know, for me, my siblings and their children, the people I love in the world. Occasionally, I admit, cat gifts, because I find cats amusing. And then, of course, some misinformation that's designed to proselytize hatred to me. And we're not in that same frame of that critical frame of mind. So that's why they're such powerful platforms. What can the end effect be? Well, think about the fact that in the past few years, there has been at least one genocide in which the hatred of Muslims of the Rohingya Muslims was actually inculcated and then operationalized and turned into an active genocide aside on a social media platform, on Facebook quite specifically.
Talk to us about maybe four or five or however many you want of the most dishonestly presented to social media issues.
Well look, I think that we have a particular problem with hate on social media platforms that has really been ineffectively dealt with over a long period of time. And the companies have been through an evolution on how they dealt with hate. Initially, they said it isn't our problem. Society is racist or religiously intolerant. It's our platforms are just a reflection of that. Increasingly, they've come to an awareness that if you are the vector, if you are the means by which hate is spread, that you hold some moral responsibility. But the issue for all of us who are campaigning for more tolerant societies in which people are able to pursue their faith and their relationship with God or whoever, whatever it is that they believe in safety and in a way that is not driven by fear, but instead by their desire for self-actualization, for understanding, then to do that, we need to reduce the prevalence, the fear of hatred that people feel. And the social media companies have accepted that they have a role to play in it. And when you've got 3.5 billion users and you are worth $100 billion because you sell the data those people give you to advertisers, I think they've started to accept that they have a moral responsibility. However, they haven't followed through on it. And In American law, the regulation that surrounds social media companies is called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act 1996. So the regulation's 25 years old, before social media was invented even. And that law is actually called the Good Samaritan Law, because it says that you aren't liable for any harm that's created on your platform, but you also have absolute protection from any moderate decisions you take to clean your platform as you wish. So you, in fact, the platforms have an absolute fundamental right to moderate their platforms, to take people off their platforms who are causing harm, and they're protected under US law from doing it. So this is the Good Samaritan law. The issue is that this is not a Good Samaritan that we're dealing with. These are greedy, venal, lazy companies who know that hate actually drives attention and engagement. They prey on the worst bits of our instincts and also the best bits as well. So they prey on on those people who want to hate. They know they're safe on social media platforms. It's a safe space for racist and religiously intolerant people. And then for those of us who argue against them, it knows that we are, as human beings, we have a fight or flight reaction. So we respond to malignant behavior. And all of that means eyeballs, engagement, controversy, loads and loads of people watching. And what are they doing while they're watching the hatred unfurl in our society? Consuming advertising. 98% of Facebook's revenue comes from advertising. And that, unfortunately, has created a sort of a pernicious cycle, a vicious cycle in which they generate more controversy for more profits. That tells their algorithms that people like controversy, so it feeds us more and more and more. And we've got companies which theoretically could do so much good to spread good information, to bring communities together, to allow people to network and find inspiration from other faiths, from other people, from other societies, and yet have been turned into machines for delivery of polarization, of vociferous narratives, of polarizing narratives that make us more brittle as a society. It's time for us to look at that and say, well, look, the economic incentives in this are all wrong, and we need to fix those. And the way to fix them is to regulate. That's what we did with, say, you know, climate change and oil, or with tobacco and the diseases that are caused by tobacco, and it can kill you. And we then regulated around it. The same is true of social media, that we're going to need to make sure that there is a cost to be paid for not being the good Samaritan that the US law allows you to be, to incentivize good behavior and disincentivize bad behavior. And I think that given what happened in the past year, where misinformation has worsened a pandemic, but also led to people who now say, I was led down the garden path, committing acts of domestic terrorism in the country that, you know, I live up the road from the capital. It was horrifying that when we see Jews feeling that they can't post on social media, that they feel they're being pushed out of public life. I know that there are historical analogies within living memory for where that leads. And I think it's time for us to change the system, because otherwise it can lead to terrible things very quickly.
You know, I remember a few years ago there were reports that a growing number of Americans rely on social media for their news and understanding of the world, which was an immensely worrying trend. In light of your work and other reports demonstrating how false much of what is posted actually is, do you see that blind trust being reduced at all, or are we still very vulnerable?
To understand social media is to understand that this is not like drinking from a tap. It's not water that you know is being regulated, is being cleaned. That this is like drinking from a stream, and you don't know who's put what inside there. And so social media, you have to be cautious when you drink from that knowledge stream, and be aware that it may have been poisoned by foreign actors, by domestic enemies, by people who just do it because it amuses them. And to be very aware that you're unsafe in that moment, and to take precautions. And I think there are going to be three parts to how we fix this problem of social media, which has so many good aspects to it, too, that we're going to have education so people understand that when they drink from those waters, they may be tainted. The second is that we're going to have sensible regulation that doesn't cripple this industry that is so economically powerful, viable, and is a strength for the United States and, you know, my home country, the United Kingdom as well, which is a leading nation in artificial intelligence that underpins these platforms, so that we have sensible regulation. And then also we're going to need to have some self-regulation by these companies. And I think a new generation of leaders will have to come forwards at those companies that understand that they have a responsibility to more than just their checkbooks, right?
This is a critically important topic. Would you tell our listeners how they can learn more about your research and to keep on the work of the center?
Our website is www.counterhate.com. People should have a look at our content there, subscribe to get updates, and to support it where you can. I mean, we're very young as an organization. We're actually turning two in a month. So we haven't really ever thought through things like fundraising and other things before. But please, in the meantime, just your support when you talk to other people, and to look at some of the things that we've written, like Don't Feed the Trolls, and think about the role that you can play as an individual in educating others about both the positives of social media, the dangers, and also what we should be doing as individuals to make sure we don't become part of the problems ourselves.
Imrod Ahmed is the CEO of the Center for Countering Digital Hate, an immense undertaking that is immensely important. Follow the work at the center at counterhate.com. Imran, thank you so much for being with us today, and you're always welcome at State of Belief Radio.
It was such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
The Reverend Spencer Burke has been a leader in progressive Christianity for decades, going beyond simply working for a more inclusive or just vision of religion. He has relentlessly been at the forefront of reinventing faith communities and spaces as well as ministry. With a multi-month program underway leading up to Solarize 2021 gatherings in October, I am intrigued to welcome him to State of Belief Radio. Spencer, it's great to have you with us.
Well, thank you. I so appreciate it. It's great to be with you.
Solarize 2021. You're calling it a hybrid learning party. It's been underway now since June. So talk about what all of that means, if you would.
Yeah, well, so the title, Soul Arise, you know, S-O-U-L-A-R-I-Z-E, and it's a play on the word of kind of a photographic term of how everything seemed to have been so black and white. But then 20 years ago, when we started Solarize as a pop-up event, we realized that things were not so black and white. Things were a little bit more gray. And that was the technique of it. And so Solarize has been a pop-up event over the last 20 years. The first one we did was kind of at such a time as this. It was just less than 30 days after the 9/11 incident. And we felt like, you know, we gathered people together, and we had 30 Native American tribes represented that did a Native American potlatch. We had a film festival. We had a whole number of different things. So this year, we decided to revive it because it felt like it again after COVID and everything else. It was such a time as this. And so again, we asked why and how. And really, the why was, I think we needed to be together, you know, and we realized a lot of people couldn't come together physically for a variety of reasons. And so we said, well, why don't we do a hybrid, which is both and, you know, which again, I think postmodernism, the whole thing has always been a little bit more about both and. You know, it's not just church in a building or church outside a building. You know, it's the church. And Solarize in the same way is taking that on, so that we really want to be able to invite people who won't be willing to travel, but can join us anywhere in the world through the app, or they could be with us in person in Fullerton in October 21st, 2nd, and 3rd.
So for whom are you doing Solarize, and for those who want to be on, how do they get on?
So Solarize has always been for what we call spiritual innovators. So if you think about the innovation curve, you know, it's just a little hill kind of an idea. At the front end, you have the innovators, which are about 3% of the population. And then they have the early adopters, which is about another 13%. So 16% of the population tend to be in those early adopters and also innovators. And so that's who Solarize has always reached. So these are people who feel like they've not really fit in the past, or they've been a little bit ahead, you know, where they've been talking about things and 5 years later, people in the spirit community might be talking about them. So it's really designed for people who are looking for a community of people who are thinking about doing faith works in a little different way. This year, we've expanded it. So traditionally, it's been kind of within just the Christian tradition. But this year, we have Rabbi Babchuk, who's running our startup pitches, and he's out of Glean, an incubator out of Manhattan. We have a number of people that are coming in from different worldviews to connect in. So we think it's more about faith rather than strictly Christianity. Like, we can learn so much from our brothers and sisters who are doing faithful spiritual work throughout whatever place they may find themselves. And the way that people can connect is real simply utilizing the app. You can go to Solarize, SOLARIZE.live, LIVE, Solarize.live. And for $19.95, you can join the conversation from anywhere in the world.
Spencer, what kind of impact have you seen this work have on faith leaders and communities over the years?
Well, so it's kind of fun to be able to look back after 20 years. And I left the megachurch world about then, and I just ventured out. We started a little website called theooze.com, which was gathering people who were having these conversations. And then we thought, you know, how about if we gathered people together in a one place offline? And so we, those who had the luxury of traveling, did that. And so 20 years ago, we had Brian McLaren, who was just a pastor, and he was looking and thinking about these things and testing his ideas. And he'd written a few books. Then also I had been doing some work with the Enneagram with Father Richard Rohr. And so I invited him, and Brian and Richard had never met each other. In fact, it was the first time Father Rohr had been to an evangelical event. And so they met, and they tell the story about that. It's so fun. And so it's been a place where we've invited people to test their ideas. It's kind of prototyping, right? You know, it's coming in and saying, will this stick? And I'd remind everybody that every orthodoxy starts with a heresy. Now, not every heresy becomes orthodoxy. And so a lot of our workshops, I don't know if you heard the latest Christianity Today deal on how Mars Hills die or whatever with Mark Driscoll idea, but in the show they interviewed me and they pivot Mark's downfall at Solarize in Seattle 20 years ago. That was the time where, whoops, this is not something we should be a part of. So Solarize really is a place where there's a wide variety of viewpoints and ideas. And those that last, like a Richard Rohr or a Brian McLaren or a number of people who have kind of tested out. In fact, so many of their workshops have become books, or so many of their relationships, you know, conferences, you meet in the hallway. That's usually the best thing. You never really remember a keynote speaker, but so many of those relationships that were built just in the hallways or out over a drink or at lunch or whatever, really ended up creating whole new organizations that today we think of as just the middle of the road, where back then they were the cutting edge things that were happening.
Humane spirituality. I love the phrase. Talk about the theme, if you would.
So we have never really done a theme before. It's always been just come and gather. We called it a learning party, right? And people gathered together. But this year we thought, you know what? We need to not just have a conversation. We need to take action. We need to really begin to develop people and programs and ideas that have legs that can move out into the world with love, care, and compassion. So the theme this year is humane spirituality. And the way I loosely define it right now is humane spirituality restores human dignity to both the oppressed and the oppressor. So it's not one-sided. It's the idea, because I think social entrepreneurism really can go in and just change the unjustness of the world, but maybe not look at our own selves. Spiritual entrepreneurism or spiritual innovation really comes by a point where we sit down and ask ourselves. The reason why I've chosen the idea of humane spirituality is, I don't know about you, but I wrote a book a number of years ago called Heretic's Guide to Eternity. Right. Got me in a lot of trouble with questioning whether there's heaven and hell and all that stuff, right? But now I'm confused with the idea of sin. You know, like, it's so difficult because in the last 4 years, I've watched a number of my friends call something sin that I thought was good. And then they'd call something, you know, good that I thought was absolute sin. You know what I mean? And it was a wild place where I go, wait a minute, we can't even agree on what's evil or sin in this world. And so I thought, you know what? It really gets down to human dignity. And so a humane spirituality looks at an individual and we ask not the question whether it's sin or not sin, biblical, not biblical, whatever. We really get down to the idea of human dignity. Is it really restoring human dignity? And we look and we say, that action feels to me like it's inhumane. And I think we all kind of generally, when we get past the politics and the theology, we can settle in there and go, ouch, that hurts my soul. That takes away from another human being who's created in the image of God. That destroys that image, you know. And then when we watch and we get a tear in your, I don't know if you know, like I allow myself to kind of weep in movies and other things, you know, and it's usually at points where just deep human dignity is restored to another human being. And that, I say, is good, you know. And so that's our theme.
So, Spencer, in a nutshell, why should someone hearing this decide to get involved with Solarize 2021?
Well, there's two different ways that I think people play. Right now, we're gathering all of the workshops and the keynote speakers, as well as arts, as well as startup pitches. And so people can actually submit their own work. It's created by and for the community itself. So right now, people could go to solarize.live and actually apply to host a village in their own community. They can actually put up artwork, whether it's a short film, music, spoken word. And then if their application is accepted, and virtually anyone who fits in the theme of humane spirituality will be accepted, then they'll be able to put up their pitch area, you know, their pitch page. And that's where everybody gets all this exposure and beauty and wonder, and people can respond and play. That's starting today. That was actually June 1st. But right now, people are already putting in their pitches and workshops and ideas. Then from there, we'll select the ones that'll be part of the mainstreaming program that'll go worldwide October 21st, 2nd, and 3rd. But the second half of people are people who just don't have the time to do that, but really want to hear and see some of the latest ideas swirling around and maybe even find, you know, conversation partners or collaborative groups to be involved in cohorts. Yeah. And so they can join in. Everything will be posted by September 27th. And so the event really starts on the 27th. One of the beautiful parts is that people come in and watch the workshops ahead of time. So really the live program is actually a place in which people are in conversation, not necessarily just watching a dead video.
Spencer Burke is a longtime spiritual innovator and organizer. His books include A Heretic's Guide to Eternity and Making Sense of Church. You can learn more about the Global Learning Party we've been discussing at solararise.org, and we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. Spencer, this is really interesting, and I appreciate you being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you so much for your work. I so appreciate it.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week. One person for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man, you see.